This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today's subject is very timely because we are now in the wake of a devastating hurricane season with major hits to the Houston area, to Puerto Rico, and to Florida. Many of the Caribbean islands have been completely devastated. Houses flooded, high waters at an unprecedented level. And the devastation really has occurred in both an acute way, but there will be a terrible toll going forward from the aftermath of these disasters. And today we're going to talk to an expert, Dr. Richie Shoemaker. He's a medical doctor. He's a recognized leader in patient care, research, and education, and a pioneer in the field of biotoxin-related illness. And so he's going to give us a perspective on mold toxicity and environmental toxicity that just goes beyond sneezing, wheezing, and nuisance symptoms. It's way beyond just allergic problems. Illness acquired following exposure to water-damaged buildings comprises the bulk of Dr. Shoemaker's daily practice. And he actually has been called upon to do congressional testimony on this subject. He leads the way not only identifying the cause of complex illnesses like chronic fatigue syndrome and multiple chemical sensitivity, but also in curing those whom the medical community has deemed incurable. He's a real innovator in this field. He graduated from Duke University, got his undergraduate and MD degrees there, and he has also published 8 books, the newest being, and I recommend it very highly, Surviving Mold. And that is the concept behind today's program. So welcome to Intelligent Medicine. It's a pleasure having you here.
Well, I'm absolutely delighted to speak with you, and thank you so much for your kind invitation.
It's my pleasure. And, you know, you are the go-to guy on this subject. So frame the issue for us. You know, what happens in the aftermath of these kinds of natural disasters?
When there's water intrusion, either from a flood or hurricane storm damage, or just from a pipe that leaks in behind the closet in the bathroom, the series of events that occurs is essentially the same. For our disaster victims, the time course is compressed and truncated, but they're initially with water providing one of the necessary 3 elements for microbes to grow. When water saturation exceeds 60%, kind of a minimum, there will be growth first of some fungi that we've come to know with names like Wollemia, and they're xerophilic, or they like the drier areas. Some bacteria will grow in a lot of actinomycetes. These are, as Dr. Hoffman, you know, they're kind of filamented organisms that live between worlds of fungi and bacteria, but actinomycetes end up being the groups of organisms that nobody really talks very much about.
Mm-hmm. Well, actinomycetes is actually responsible for some devastating infections in immunosuppressed patients, patients who receive immunotherapy for immunosuppressive therapy for cancer or autoimmune disease. It's a rare infection, but becoming more prevalent because people's immune systems are really down.
One of the issues that we're facing looking at actinomycetes, for example, is that for every 10 papers on mycotoxin or fungal toxin that we see published, there will be 1 or 2 at most on actinomycetes. And as it turns out, when we get around to talking about ribotoxins, the kind of new thing that your podcast today will be bringing out to the country that other people have not, it is actinomycetes and then bacteria that cause the vast majority of illness, even though when you hear about floods, you hear about mold and black mold and toxic mold. Those are, I guess mold's got a real good public relations agent because they talk about mold when they shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. But having said that, after the initial phase of initial microbial growth, it doesn't take too long if water saturation rises to 70 to 80% before we find Aspergillus species moving in. And when water saturation gets to 90 to 100%, that's when Stachybotrys, the black mold, gets going, and Ketomium as well. So when we think about an indoor environment with water damage, we can almost divide the ecology and divide the microbes that grow in that ecology by water saturation. Because when you think about it, there's not too much inside a home that these microbes cannot eat. You'll find microbes growing on concrete, for God's sake. So that it's not just cellulose and drywall, it's not just dropped ceilings, it's not just wood, it's not just the tennis shoes and then kind of forgotten in the closet. Essentially, all foodstuffs that we have in our house are available for consumption. Growth conditions are right, organisms not only grow, but they will be able to glean enough energy from the environment to start to do two things. One is to make secondary products of metabolism, and then the second thing they make are elements that are used to defeat plant defenses. Hmm. Now, when I say elements to defeat plant defenses, fungi have been preying on plants for years, and plants have been preventing being predated upon by fungi for years. And what happens is that some of the peroxidase functions that plants make to ward off fungi are extremely efficient in doing so, and our friends the fungi have learned to make mycotoxins that people are defense mechanisms. They're not. What they are compounds that destroy plant defense mechanisms. Mm-hmm. But you only see that when there's enough food and water conditions are right. So when someone talks about a water damage building from a slow drip, it's going to be a prolonged period where we don't have a lot of things. Well, if we look at homes in Houston and in Florida, the time course to serious personal risk is that's all it takes. The mechanism of injury is released by these microbes of particulates into the air mm-hmm. of the indoor environment.
So this is different than allergy, because a lot of people say, well, I start to wheeze when I'm around in an attic or something, or I get nasal congestion. But this is it's a separate, complete mechanism that's separate and distinct from ordinary allergy. Can you explain the difference?
You are right on the button. If we think about immune response as acquired immunity, which means antibody-based, that's where allergy lives. The problems I deal with have nothing to do with allergy. Measures of allergy like IgE will be fairly high in nasal allergy and high in allergic asthma, but they're completely normal, in fact, below normal in our water damage building patients. Hmm. So specifically, we then look at the other side of the immune response. This is where we have innate immune mechanisms. Now, innate immunity is built in. Everybody's got it. And it's there to serve all of us, speaking theologically, as a warning mechanism. It's the sentry at the gate. And the job of the sentry, if the gate is being traversed by the bad guys, is to alert the rest of the base or whatever apartment complex might be that says, we got a problem. Now, in innate immunity, the bad guys are antigens, foreign particles that are not us. And normally, an antigen can be recognized by innate immune mechanisms that begin with inflammation. Then we set off special white blood cells to begin antigen presentation, and T cells get involved, and then B cells get involved, and then we get an antibody that are specific that wipe out the specific antigen. That process falls apart in inflammatory response syndromes.
So to simplify, in allergy, it's almost like you get a hyperreactive immune system. In biotoxin exposure, and whether it be mold or, you know, some other agents, you actually get immunosuppression. The whole immune system collapses.
No, let's work on that a little bit.
Okay.
What you have is reduction of antibody response,
mm-hmm.
but marked expansion.
Okay.
Of inflammatory responses. This is not an immune suppressed. If we look at some of the players involved with funny names like MMP9 or matrix mm-hmm. metalloproteinase 9 and C4A and TGF-beta1, these elements define the presence of an illness by their marked elevation.
Mm.
What gets suppressed are levels of hormones, neuroregulatory peptides, they're called, MSH, melanocyte-stimulating hormone, and VIP, vasoactive intestinal polypeptide. Those levels will fall, but more importantly, as they fall, they give up the ability to regulate inflammatory responses.
Okay. So it's just that you lose your brakes, in effect, I mean, to by analogy.
Yep. As this illness passes, most of the manifestations early on are peripheral, and here where people might, mm-hmm. you know, have some fatigue, and might have a headache, and might have a cough. There is going to be lack of the ability to remove the offending antigens, such that when you leave a pastoral environment full of ragweed and you're allergic to ragweed, you don't start sneezing anymore. But when you leave a water-damaged building, you don't stop the innate immune response at all. You mm-hmm. carry the antigen with you, so the illness continues. It continues over time, and it takes about 3 to 4 days before we find activation of particular pro-inflammatory genes that can be recognized readily with transcriptomics. And now we have a double problem. We have carriage of antigens setting off peripheral inflammatory response, but our nucleus now is telling us to take the wraps off pro-inflammatory elements and suppress anti-inflammatory elements. So as this disease progresses and things like beta-1 start turning on gene activation, there's a second phase of much greater severity, much greater permanence. And here's where we deal with some of the scary issues. One of the papers we published back in March of this year looked at individuals who had injury to the brain, as shown by an FDA-cleared software program called NeuroQuant, which caused gray matter nuclear atrophy. And if you have listeners worried about dementia and Alzheimer's and all that, they're going to know about gray matter atrophy. Yeah. If you haven't heard about gray matter, as we get older, the substance starts to get smaller, but when we have an inflammatory response, cortical gray and then forebrain parenchyma, which is white matter, is actually ones that start getting bigger. And microscopic interstitial edema is occurring after this injury to blood-brain barrier. Meanwhile, after the blood-brain barrier is breached, and TGF-beta1 and some other elements can get into the brain where they shouldn't, mm-hmm. they will turn off the mechanisms that permit brain to heal on their own.
Hmm. So clinically, what are we going to see in this population, short-term and long-term, how are people going to become aware that they may be negatively affected by exposure to mold? Because it is invisible. I mean, yes, it's visible when it's growing on your ceiling and you see a big black splotch. But if it's ubiquitous and it's, you know, in the air, and maybe it smells a little musty, but it's really hard to detect, how are people going to know that this is actually what's afflicting them and not just depression, post-traumatic stress syndrome, you're getting old?
The tip-off is near simultaneous occurrence of a multi-system, multi-symptom illness. Because this is inflammatory, and the inflammation-causing chemicals, cytokines, if you will, complement, if you will, TGF-beta1, if you will, excuse me, all travel within blood, and they will go everywhere that blood goes in the body. So you may have a cough separate from my cold. You may wheeze separate from my cold. Mm. You may notice that your joints are sore, but the joints are not going to be red and inflamed. You can say, no, this is not gout. It's not warm to the touch. It's not hugely swollen.
So more like an achy flu-like feeling.
Achy flu-like is one of the early tip-offs, but headache goes along with that. Mm-hmm. Runny nose, rarely, but red eyes, yeah, might make you think that you've got some allergy. When we start having neurologic problems, which can be as simple as a mild numbness or tingling, almost a peripheral neuropathy feeling, it's that time that I start worrying about what's going on in the brain. Because now you're going to have executive cognitive dysfunction. You'll have problems with recent memory, difficulty with word finding. Probably one of the first things that happened to folks in Houston is they couldn't find the words. I went down to the supermarket. And it doesn't take a long time for people to recognize that you're looking for a word that you normally would have right away. There can be psychiatric symptoms, but they're not psychiatric disease. Anxiety and depression, and you're right, these people get called depressed a lot. Anxiety is very common. Sleep disruption occurs because both MSH and VIP control circadian rhythms that regulate sleep.
So it's not just a reaction to the tragedy, the loss, the dislocation. It's there's something toxic within them that's triggering this cascade that affects all the organs, the entire body, and the brain.
You're exactly correct. Now, you will hear, and I've already heard from Houston, that there are going to be federal agencies saying this is all post-traumatic stress disorder, this is depression. We can now separate PTSD from the problems you get with chronic inflammatory response syndrome from mold using, we can show the difference in 10 seconds. It's easy. But you're also going to hear that, yeah, you might get some asthma, yeah, you might get some allergy, but they're not going to tell you about the cognitive issues. They're not going to tell you about the joint problems. They're not going to talk about debilitating chronic fatigue. And those elements all are going to continue to march. It will not be kept away by removal from exposure. Now, the only good news in this tale of disaster is that there must be genetic susceptibility for this whole cascade.
Because some people will get it and some people won't. Some people under identical circumstances, they'll come down with it. Others seem more resilient. They're the survivor rats, you know, that can eat the poison and they don't succumb.
In my career getting started in this whole kind of field in 1996, it bothered me as why were three people down at Williams Point exposed to toxin-forming dinoflagellates sick, but that meant seven were not. And it took 4 years to figure out that our immune response genes, called HLA-DR, found on chromosome 6, defined who was going to have the risk and then the illness. Other people didn't have those HLAs, didn't have it. We know now there's 54 main haplotypes for HLA, and these HLAs might be more commonly known by the lay audience, because it has a lot to do with transplantation. You don't want to transplant a kidney from someone that doesn't have an HLA match.
Also susceptibility to celiac disease. The HLA is a determinant of who is more likely to have celiac.
Unfortunately, that is actually not exactly correct. And the reason I want to tell that is that back when that one study on celiac disease and HLA was published from Finland, 4,008 patients, they only looked at HLA-DR, and they did not, then they looked at DQ.
DQ, right.
So they looked at DQ2, not recognizing that that was 7253 or 17252A. Those are both mold-susceptible haplotypes. DQ8 can be 4853, which is a dinoflagellate susceptible. So in that finished study looking at celiac, where you can order that test you described from LabCorp, I find it a bit misleading. And if there is a question about celiac, I hope they have a TTG IgA done.
Oh, yeah, clearly, yeah.
But in this whole mechanism, if we look at who gets sick and why they get sick, we can start to map out sequentially over time. When will they start being colonized by organisms that we used to think were benign? Coagulase negative staph started making people sick when they made biofilm in the 80s and grew on heart valves and artificial hips. They live benignly in the nose and the skin, but they're not multiply antibiotic resistant. And we now know that they make a compound called palytoxin that is a dinoflagellate toxin that is seen essentially confined to people with a chronic inflammatory response syndrome who've been treated with antifungal medications.
Hmm.
You don't need those ever to treat this illness. Hmm. It is a bunch of baloney. And when we talk about horizontal gene transfer,
that was interesting. You're just saying that giving these people antifungal medications, which would seem to make sense, they've got some kind of mold infestation, they might have, quote, candida or something like that. I mean, that's a sort of a reflex action by integrative doctors sometimes. And you say that that can make people worse.
Not only does it make it worse, it already has. The marker for antifungal use in supposedly water damage building patients is vancomycin resistance and gentamicin resistance.
Hmm, okay.
We're bringing some monsters into bacteria. Remember, Marcons were the reservoirs for resistance factors that got passed to their big brother Staph aureus. We didn't have evidence of beta-lactam resistance in Staph aureus until it was in Koagnic Staphs first.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the other thing that's happening, and particularly in Houston, but you know everywhere where there's a disaster, is that it's not just about mold growth. There's a toxic soup that's being unleashed on the populace there. There are major, it's an industrial belt, that whole Gulf region, the coastal area there with the refineries and chemical factories. And, you know, as the waters recede, you know, they're leaving raw sewage, chemicals, and then there's mold growth. Is it possible that the mold, through this mechanism that you described, can hypersensitize people who weren't ordinarily sensitive to chemicals to multiple chemical sensitivity?
Once we lower MSX regulation, and once we set off our own DNA activation of pro-inflammatory cytokines, that's when the susceptibility to MCS and the other things get involved. There's one more mix that I want you to put in,
sure,
in some of this horror story of the soup, and that is the explosion of mosquito populations.
Okay.
Which is being treated with organophosphates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're spraying everywhere.
Let's add something else to make people bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's to people who already have an overburdened immune system. All right, this is a good point at which to pause, because we've laid out a very devastating scenario here. And in part two, let's continue our discussion of the aftermath of these hurricane disasters, but also talk about some potential solutions. What's it like for a patient who has suffered a biotoxin exposure? Is there a recovery path? What should people be seeking out? We're talking to Dr. Richie Shoemaker, who's a recognized leader in the field of mold exposure. And when we return, more on this subject. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.